So I think I'm wrong. I feel like I'm.
Good afternoon, everyone. Today is April 1st, and it is 3 o'clock in the afternoon. We are here in Hearing Room F, and I'm going to call to order the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. Senator Johnson is going to be delayed today, so I am wielding the gavel in her absence. We are going to reconvene the public hearing on House Bill 5012, the Department of Consumer and Business Affairs, and Director Allam, welcome back.
Thank you.
You can see the committee is already growing from where you left us yesterday.
Thank you.
And where would you like to begin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, Patrick Allam, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. When we left off yesterday, we had done most but not all of the worker safety system. And so today we'll begin with the remainder of that, which will consist of presentations by Oregon OSHA and the Workers' Compensation Board. Before we started, though, I thought I would just recap. We left yesterday with a couple of homework assignments, and you should have a letter on OLIS from us outlining answers to the three questions we left with yesterday. I won't go into detail regarding all of those, but I did want to touch briefly on Representative Whitsitt's question about disability. There is an answer to that question, and in summary, the data available to us about people on Social Security disability is reasonably incomplete, and so we can't be terribly conclusive, but the best data that we have is that the numbers of folks who are involved in both programs are quite small, and that there is a coordination of benefits between the two, so it's not an isolated, independently arrived at decisions that don't look to each other, and we're happy to come back and spend more time on that if you'd like.
And Director, just for the benefit of those listening in, I'll indicate that those answers to the questions will be listed on OLIS for yesterday's hearing under meeting materials. Is that
I believe they're posting today.
That's where they will reside under the first day.
So yeah, they'll reside under the first day.
Right, but you can see them for now, right now.
All right, just to make sure people know where to find that stuff.
Great.
All right, please.
All right, and so with that as a wind-up, I'd like to turn to worker health and safety. And here with me is Michael Wood, the administrator of the Occupational Safety and Health Division at the Department of Consumer and Business Services, better known as Oregon OSHA. With that, I'll turn it to Michael.
Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. Again, for the record, my name is Michael Wood, and I'm the administrator of Oregon OSHA. We view ourselves as an integral part of the overall worker safety and workers' compensation program at the department. And when you go back to the comprehensive reforms almost 25 years ago now, one of the things that came out of those reforms was a focus on prevention and a recognition that the best way, and certainly one of the most effective ways to keep workers' compensation premium rates down is actually to keep injury and illness rates down. And John Schultz talked about that some yesterday. I won't repeat his comments, but I will just say that is what we see as our primary charge, is focusing on those. In the one of the things that we point to that shows a continued success over that time is the reduction in fatalities. In the last 15 years, we've actually seen the fatality rate. So that's not the number of fatalities. That's the number of fatalities measured against the size of the workforce. We've seen that rate cut in half. And that is one of the things that we continue to see as well as the injury and illness rate as being an indication of our success. Oregon OSHA does inspections, but we're much more than an enforcement agency. We also provide a wide range of resources to employers and to workers to help address hazards in the workplace, to identify them, and to control them. We do investigate workplace injuries, particularly the most severe injuries resulting in hospitalizations or fatalities. We also are able to resolve most of the appealed cases in relation to our enforcement through an informal dispute resolution process within the agency. Our appeals go, if they go beyond us, they actually go to the Workers' Compensation Board, and you'll be hearing more about that a little bit later. As we look at how we plan to accomplish our mission over the next couple of years, our focus is going to be on building on those things that have made us and really have made the overall system successful in the past. One of the things that has relied upon And the first bullet here is maintaining a strong presence in the workplace. With both our enforcement and our consultation staff, one of the things that was recognized in the comprehensive reforms is the value of a robust presence. And although it's slipped in recent years and over the last couple decades, we continue to have the highest enforcement presence in the country among all the state programs as well as federal OSHA. At the same time, we have a comparable presence when it comes to offering on-site consultation. Both sides of that have been historically well-resourced by the legislature, and it has paid dividends. We do have, based on workload, a portion of the policy option package that would add 4 staff to the division. 2 of those boots on the ground doing direct enforcement work, one of them doing direct consultation work, and another one in our technical program supporting our publications, resource materials, as well as working on some projects to try to clarify our rules, present them in a manner that makes them more accessible, because frankly a rule that can't be read and understood isn't a rule that's likely to have a lot of effect in changing the behavior of either workers or employers. But I won't go through the details of the other strategies that are outlined there, but we will continue to use a comprehensive approach. I think one of the things that has worked well for Oregon over the last 20 plus years is the fact that we have a broad strategy, and we don't rely on simply using any single tool in our toolkit. We do rely very heavily on partnerships. When I talk about the success of the Oregon system, it really isn't Oregon OSHA's success. It's the success of an overall system. It's the success of workers in the state. It's the success of employers. And it's the success of professional associations. We do a lot of collaborative activity, working with the American Society of Safety Engineers and other groups to put on conferences, to put on other venues that allow us to help promote getting things right and getting things right in the workplace. We have responsibility in that context for one of the key performance measures, and that relates to the occupational injury and illness incidence rates. This is one of those indicators that is at its best when it is going down. And if you look at the historic level, you can notice that we're still below the target that we set a number of years ago. We dropped very rapidly in the 2007 to 2011 period, and in the last couple of years, we've actually seen that ratchet up. I do want to put that in a broader historical context. We've seen a nearly 60% reduction since 1990. And in the last decade, overall, even with that increase at the end, it's gone up almost 30%. I also want to return to a question that Chair Gomberg asked yesterday with regard to what has driven the rates down in the long run. And while I agree with Mr. Schultz that over the long run, what has driven the rates down is really success and effective prevention, that it isn't simply a change in the mix of industries, I will point out that during the period where this dip and then resurgence in injury rates has occurred, we have seen a significant dislocation in the most hazardous industries. So we saw residential construction decline to almost nothing. We saw commercial construction cut way back. High-risk manufacturing cut way back. Forest products manufacturing cut way back. Logging cut way back, all in that period. Obviously, when you factor those into overall rates, that got us a reduction that wasn't the result of increased safety, but really was the result of a change in the industry mix. What's happening over the last few years is that, to some degree, that industry mix is recovering. Those higher hazard jobs are returning to the workforce, and unfortunately that means they bring back some higher injury rates. That's a sort of a long way of saying that as I look at this, I focus on the longer term trend. I don't think that increase over the last 2 or 3 years is really suggestive of a longer term trend. I will return to something that Director Allen said yesterday, that over time, and I think we're approaching that level, we aren't going to continue to see the rate of reduction that we've achieved over the last 10 years or over the last 20 or 25 years. The simple reality is that as we get lower, as that rate goes down, it flattens out, and our ability to, the director referred to low-hanging fruit, and I think that's exactly the analogy to use. We have harvested the low-hanging fruit. Further success is achievable, but it will come at a greater challenge. And then the final thing I want to touch on was, again, returning to a question that Chair Gomberg asked yesterday with regard to what's happening in other states. As a general principle, what's happening nationally and in most other states is that we have seen a continuing decrease. The overall system in most states is pushing the injury and illness rate down, but not at a rate as rapid as it has gone down in Oregon. The other thing I would add to that is a number of other states haven't seen the sort of decrease in the most severe injuries and particularly in fatality rates that we have seen. So while it's reflective of what is good news nationally, I think it's fair to say that the news in Oregon over the long haul has been even better and is really reflective of some good solid decisions that were made long ago by this body in terms of how to make a comprehensive system work. That's the end of my prepared comments. I don't know if that prompts any additional questions.
You just stole my line. Colleagues, any questions? Senator Monroe.
I worked at Metro for 12 years, and we had a constant effort to reduce workforce injuries. Metro does, among other things, runs the zoo and some things that can be relatively dangerous. And there was a concerted effort to get our injury and accident rate down. When a business is successful, when a corporation is successful in reducing injuries, do they benefit financially, and how?
Chair Johnson, Senator Monroe, that's a very good question, and the short answer is absolutely they benefit financially. Most of those benefits, although not all of them, come through the workers' compensation system. If they're a self-insured employer or if they're a large enough employer or in a high enough risk industry that they benefit very directly from their own experience, they get a benefit in either reduced costs for self-insured or reduced premiums for those who are in the marketplace. And even smaller employers who may not get as much direct experience rating benefit when they're able to be successful as a group and they push the rates down. The numbers that Mr. Schultz showed you yesterday about what's happened with the workers' compensation premiums in this state for the last 25 years, I believe are an indication of the success overall in many respects in preventing injuries and illness before they occur. There's also a good deal of research in the safety and health literature that points out that a robust safety and health program has benefits in terms of reduced training costs, reduced absenteeism for other reasons. Frequently, depending on the particular measures, they're actually coupled with increased productivity. For some folks, that's counterintuitive. They tend to think safety takes time and costs money. Frequently, well-designed safety programs actually can have the opposite effect. So I think that certainly a focus like that pays immediate dividends for an employer. The challenge for any employer, and frankly the challenge for an entire system, is to maintain that focus and commitment year after year. I think the biggest challenge we face to safety and health in this state is the issue of complacency. We're pretty good at this, but we're not perfect, and we still have work to do.
Thank you.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment, and I don't think either the division or the department are giving themselves enough credit. This is simply not low-hanging fruit. You do not have the kinds of reductions in both workplace accidents on the one hand, and the reduction now in pure premium rates for workers' comp on the other hand. I mean, two sides of the very same coin. You don't do that for the better part of three decades just by picking low-hanging fruit, gentlemen. It is a systemic change which Oregon has led the nation in, and thank God we're finally leading the nation in something positive, and we have you to thank for that. This is not low-hanging fruit. This is systemic change that you have done an exceedingly superior job on, so thank you for that.
I'm not even going to ask for any more questions.
We
you want to take
on.
That one and run. Thank you, Representative Witt.
Thanks very much. What I'd like to do now is move on to the Workers' Compensation Board, and while While Michael and Holly Summers are changing chairs, the Workers' Compensation Board is an exception to the general notion that agency appeals are heard by the Office of Administrative Hearings. This is an adjudicatory body that deals with OSHA and workers' compensation disputes. It's a bit of an organizational anomaly in that Ms. Summers is appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate, as are the other members of the board, and it is in a large sense an independent agency organizationally held within DCBS. And so sometimes when you look at it, for instance, for budget purposes, it looks like part of DCBS, and for other purposes, it's a bit separate. So with that, I'll turn it over to Holly Summers to talk about the board.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Ms. Summers.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, member of the committee. I am Holly Summers, Chair of the Workers' Compensation Board, and as Director Allen said, the Workers' Compensation Board is an independent agency within DCBS. Our mission is to provide timely and impartial resolution of disputes arising out of the Workers' Compensation Law and the Oregon Safe Employment Act. Because workers' compensation comprises the vast majority of our caseload, I'll talk a little bit about those first. By way of context, workers' compensation disputes had historically been subject to the state civil court system and on the docket for judges around the state. However, 40 years ago, the legislature provided for exclusive jurisdiction with the Workers' Compensation Board for any matter concerning a claim. In addition to creating a specialized forum with expertise in workers' compensation cases and freeing up the state courts with that volume of cases, the legislature sought to minimize the adversarial nature of compensation proceedings. So fast forward to 2015. Our hearings division receives over 6,300 requests for resolution each year. The majority of these cases are resolved by way of settlement. Each settlement must be reviewed and approved by an administrative law judge. For the rest of the cases, we resolve these disputes in primarily two ways, by holding hearings and by providing mediation services. When a party requests a hearing, we set that hearing to occur within 90 days of the receipt of the request. In part due to our relatively new electronic docketing system, we've been able to accomplish this 90-day mark with 97% of the hearings. They're presided over by administrative law judges, all of whom are members of the Oregon State Bar. Typically, parties are represented by counsel. During the hearing, exhibits are admitted, testimony is taken, and oral argument is presented. The ALJs are not bound by formal rules of evidence. Rather, they can conduct the hearing in any manner that they think will achieve substantial justice. At the conclusion of the hearing and within 30 days of the record closure, the ALJs issue written decisions. These opinion and orders have findings of fact and conclusions of law. In 2014, 97% of our opinion and orders were also issued within that 30 days. The second primary way we resolve disputes is through mediation. We have a very strong mediation program at WCB, and we see this alternative dispute resolution program as integral to our mission here. WCB offers these mediation services, or we've been offering them for about 18 years now, and since that time, it's been our program has been the model for other programs in other states. Parties' participation in mediation is completely voluntary, and we offer these at no cost to the litigants. ALJs meet with the parties in an effort to settle the case or at least to try to narrow the issues for hearing. The mediation program is constantly growing, and in 2014, we held 400 mediations, which resulted in settlement 91% of the time.
Let me stop you for just a moment. Do you track your costs? Because I would imagine sometimes these mediations can be protracted. While I don't disagree with the notion that they would occur for no fee, I'm wondering, have you explored the notion of a fee so that the parties are invested in an expeditious settlement? Have you talked about any of those kinds of issues, or has free been such a good model in achieving positive outcomes that you'd prefer to keep it on a no-fee basis?
It is a very robust program, and our stakeholders have been very, very pleased with the results. It's hard to quantify the cost savings that we realize or don't realize by doing mediations, because when you settle a case, you also are taking care of future situations that might arise. So it's hard to put a dollar figure on the value of any particular mediation. We do track our costs, though, that are associated with mediation as opposed to hearings.
Could you give us a sense of scale for the costs involved in the mediation?
I cannot. Senator Johnson, I cannot right now, but I can get that information together. I can tell you that about a third of our workload is aimed at mediation and two-thirds with hearings.
Thank you.
Okay.
It's a pretty impressive settlement rate.
It is. Yes, we have a very good bar, and our stakeholders are very involved with mediation, and we're very proud of it.
One more thing. When you define stakeholders, we've got new members of the committee, would you broadly define what comes under that heading of stakeholders?
Primarily, we have litigants, the claimants and the employers and insurers, as well as the attorneys that appear before us. We also consider our other state agencies, anyone who uses our forum or that we can assist with what we do.
Thank you.
Okay.
Please continue.
So we talked about mediation, board review. Our hearings division is actually the front line of dispute resolution, but there's also a second level of administrative review at the board, and that rests with our board review division. The board itself consists of five members, as Director Allen mentioned, five full-time members who are appointed by the governor for four-year terms subject to Senate confirmation. To ensure that the interests of employees and employers are fairly represented, two members are appointed that have a background in and understanding of employers and two employees. The board chair represents the interests of the public. Once appointed, all members apply the law impartially. The five-member board is the appellate body that reviews ALJ's workers' compensation decisions on appeal. Sitting in panels of one employer and one employee member, the panel reviews the written record from the hearings division as well as the record, the arguments made in board review. And working together, those two members determine the appropriate outcome. If they're unable to agree, then the public member serves as the tiebreaker. And that happens about 20% of the time. The board issues published opinion or orders on review, which are subject to appeal to the Court of Appeals, and we seek to maintain a high affirmation rate at the Court of Appeals. For 2014, our affirmation rate was 93%. So the Workers' Compensation Board is also the decision-making body for OSHA cases. These hearings provide a means for employers to contest citations and civil penalties arising from the workplace safety inspections conducted by OSHA officials. These are also due process hearings, and they're held by a specialized group of administrative law judges in the hearings division. In 2014, there were 32 requests for hearing of OSHA citations. Appeals of the ALJ's OSHA orders go directly to the Court of Appeals. In addition to workers' compensation and OSHA cases, the board also has jurisdiction over crime victims cases. These are cases that are on appeal from the Department of Justice decisions regarding a victim's application for benefits under the Crime Victims Assistance Program. We have had six hearings held in the last 2 years. I also want to highlight...
Could you go back and touch on that just for a minute? The general issue is that the remuneration wasn't adequate for the damages suffered, or what's the nature or the character of the cases?
I can give you more thorough information in writing, but in general, these are when crime victims have made application to the Department of Justice, generally for medical bills or even lost time, I believe, when they've been victim of crime and the Department of Justice, for whatever reason, had denied those benefits.
Thank you. I don't want you to do the additional research. I was just trying to get a flavor of the character of the issue.
Okay. Thanks. I'd like to highlight a relatively new service that we are offering to stakeholders, and that's our WCB portal that Director Allen touched on yesterday. Although it's not a large-scale technology project, we've been able to utilize in-house expertise to develop the portal in which our stakeholders can conduct business with WCB electronically. It's been a huge success so far, and our stakeholders are consistently asking for more and more services to be available online. In February of this year, the number of requests for hearing filed through the portal actually exceeded those filed through the paper process. This was a significant landmark for us. Parties can also access case information, such as dates and locations of hearings, details on prior case-related events. They can even download orders through the portal. Our current project is acceptance of settlement documents through the portal, which will expedite the resolution of cases, getting benefits to the injured workers sooner, and giving employers and insurers the ability to clear their reserves sooner. Both WCB and the stakeholders will realize significant savings in mailing costs as well. So the slide that we might have skipped just kind of gives a recap of the things that we just discussed: timely and partial resolution of disputes and maintaining the high affirmation rate with the Court of Appeals, and continuing to enhance the docket system and the portal. And this is our, oh, there's that one. Back to the key performance measure. It's the number of cases we decide that are affirmed by the Court of Appeals. And as I mentioned earlier, our affirmation rate for 2014 was 93%.
Colleagues, any questions of Ms. Summers?
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your excellent testimony.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, that concludes the portion of the presentation on the worker safety system. And while we do another chair change, I thought I would stop there and see, over the span of what we covered yesterday and today regarding worker safety, workers' compensation, ombudsman functions, the board, are there any questions that you still have about any of that that we can touch on before we shift gears and move to consumer protection?
Colleagues? I guess, Mr. Allen, I have one, mm-hmm. and that's on your ombudsman's function. To what degree you are reporting back to individual legislators that you are working a case involving one of their constituents in an ombudsman venue?
Thank you, Chair Johnson. I have also been unsuccessful in finding a plural gender-neutral version of ombudsman, so I share your struggle. As a matter of course, we don't independently reach out to you with every one of your constituents who contact us directly in an ombudsman kind of a circumstance, but very frequently you are making referrals to us either directly to the ombudsman, the relevant ombudsman office, or to the department generically that gets the ombudsman involved. And if that happens, we work very hard to make sure that you are looped directly back into that discussion. And so whether it's an injured worker who's having challenges with aspects of a claim, or I know we've spoken directly about a couple of times about constituents in your district who've had issues about classification of their employees, we try to make sure you're well informed of what's going on in those circumstances.
Thank you. All right.
All right. With that, then, I'd like to turn to consumer protection. As I mentioned at the kickoff yesterday, everything that you've heard about so far in the agency is funded out of a single fund, the premium assessment operating account. That's the tax on workers' compensation premiums that pays for the work of the worker safety system. And so as we went through each division, we didn't go into any sort of detailed division by division funding because it's a shared resource across those functions. That'll shift a little bit now as we move into insurance, finance, corporate securities, and building codes, because this is where most of the 500 individual fees and the 30 dedicated statutorily dedicated funds occur, as you've given us these slivers of authority that I talked about yesterday in the overview. What I'd like to do is kick off consumer protection with the insurance division and turn the presentation over to Laura Calley, who is the administrator of the insurance division and is Oregon's insurance commissioner. Laura?
Thank you, Pat. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Laura Calley, and as Director Allen said, I am the administrator for the Insurance Division and the State's Insurance Commissioner. So as Director Allen mentioned, the Insurance Division is one of the agency's divisions that's focused on consumer protection. Specifically, the division is the insurance regulator for the state, and so our mission is to empower and protect consumers in Oregon's insurance markets. In the context of insurance, consumer protection really means that insurance companies have enough money to pay their claims when due to their policyholders and beneficiaries, that consumers are treated fairly as policyholders and beneficiaries, that the rates being charged are adequate, and that the coverage being provided complies with all of our laws and requirements and provides the necessary consumer protections. And so that really kind of boils down into consumers getting value for the money that they're paying for insurance products in this state. regulation is particularly important in the insurance market because of the complexity of insurance. And so I often like to kind of harken back to my economics background and think of this as kind of a classic problem in economics where you've got the seller who has a lot more information about the product being sold than the consumer. And so that's why we exist here, to try to level that playing field, provide information to consumers, and also provide oversight and regulation to the players in the market. So I'll talk a little bit about how we accomplish our goal of regulation. So I mentioned that we do this through a combination of education and regulation. But I want to point out that our authority is quite broad and also stretches across essentially all lines of insurance that are sold in the state. There's a lot of emphasis on health insurance these days, but I always feel the need to remind folks that we regulate property casualty insurance, so things like homeowners insurance or general liability insurance that a small business might buy, life insurance, annuities. We really do regulate it all. And we do this in a couple of main ways. We ensure that the insurance companies and the insurance professionals in the state meet all of our licensing and financial requirements. We ensure that the products are meeting all of the coverage requirements and rate requirements. And you know, as I mentioned, we also ensure that consumers are really treated fairly when they're out in the market. So I'd like to share a little bit of detail about how we do each of those things. And I'm actually back on the slide. So our financial regulation and producer licensing section is responsible for that kind of initial that initial work to ensure that the companies and the professionals meet all the requirements in the state. And a key piece of that is making sure that insurance companies have sufficient funds to pay claims. And so we conduct ongoing analysis of their finances. We conduct periodic examinations of insurance companies that are based in Oregon. And all of that is really focused to make sure that we have a good understanding of the risks that face those insurers, and that when it comes time for them to pay claims, they are solvent, and insurance consumers get what they need when they file a claim. The next major area of the insurance division is our product regulation section. And that section is responsible for reviewing and approving policy forms. And so this is the contract language that's contained in insurance policies that people buy. And you know, as I mentioned, we regulate many different lines of insurance, and there are hundreds of insurance companies that write business in the state. So that translates into a significant workload for the division. And finally, our market regulation section is responsible for monitoring the conduct of all of the entities that we regulate when they're actually out in the market offering their products and services. And so that's where we're making sure that insurance companies are living up to the promises in their contracts, that they're following the law, that agents are doing the same. And this also includes our consumer advocacy team, and I'm going to talk a little bit about them in more detail. The consumer advocacy team, I think, is probably one of the big highlights about the work that we do, and it's a great resource for Oregonians. As many of you may be aware, last year we launched an awareness campaign, really to try to get the word out about the services of our consumer advocates. And for those who may be less familiar with their work, we have a team of consumer advocates that answer the phone. A live person answers the phone from 8 to 5 p.m., and they are available to answer questions for consumers. If someone runs into a problem with their insurer or their agent, our consumer advocates actually, you know, work the files, call the insurers, call the agents, and try to resolve the situation as best they can. And we have done some work to kind of see if our campaign was successful in raising awareness, and we saw an increase of about 17% in awareness of our services across the state after the first year. So we think that that's a great signal of success, but we think we still have some work to do to get the word out about this service.
Let me ask you to be a little more nuanced about that. When you surveyed, it was, did you see our billboard versus did you avail yourself of our services? How did you ask the question? One thing's driving by on I-5 and seeing the picture and the big billboard of your ad. The other is how many people actually used you.
Chair Johnson, so we asked actually several questions when we did this survey. So we did ask the questions that you asked, which were, did you see our billboard? but we also asked, do you know who we are? Do you know what we do? Are you aware that there's someone in the state that regulates insurance? Are you aware that we have a consumer complaint hotline? We did ask those kinds of questions. So when we asked the question that led to my statement about 17% increase, what we asked was, are you aware of the insurance division? And so not so much did you see our advertising, but we did ask those questions as well.
Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Kelly, two questions. What other media do you use for advertising other than billboards, and what's your total advertising budget?
Co-chairs and Representative Nierman. So we used a number of different types of media in 2014. So we had billboards. We also had some TV ads and radio ads, and there was some digital advertising as well. And I should mention that we spent a lot of time working with our stakeholders, you know, including consumers, insurers across the board, to make sure we were hitting the right note, not suggesting that people should be expecting to have a problem, but just saying we're here, we're a resource. This was something we did for the first time in 2014. And our budget was $1.2 million, and that runs all the way through June 30th of 2015. And I should mention also that the funding from that came from a multi-state settlement that we were a member of through our group of state insurance regulators that came from life insurance companies who were not properly using the Social Security Death Master file. Okay, thank you. So looking ahead to next biennium, I want to talk about a couple of the key areas that we're going to be focusing on as priorities. So first, I talked a little bit about our market regulation team, which is really ensuring that that things are occurring in the market as they should be. We are in the initial stages of enhancing our market regulation program to have a stronger market intelligence focus. And so we're trying to do more to be an early warning system. And still we're certainly going to have our consumer advocacy unit and use complaints to kind of help us understand issues that are occurring in the market. But we think that by really having more of a market intelligence focus, we can address problems before they become more severe and more systemic and get swifter results for consumers. And so I wanted to bring this up because we are requesting in one of our policy packages one additional staff person to help us with this work. When we went to the e-board last year and requested the authority to hire an enforcement officer, and we were able to do so on a limited duration basis, and the individual in that position has been really helpful in helping us with case strategy, providing policy support to our market regulation staff. And so you'll see in our policy option package that we're asking to make that a permanent position.
Mr. Allen, a question to you, and I apologize. I missed the latter part of your presentation yesterday. Have you shared with the committee at all how many people have left DCBS, and under the circumstances of the economic downturn, you were shedding some very skilled folks? I want to put a personnel request in the context of what you as a manager, the decisions that you made earlier, and now basically as the economy's coming back and there are other issues, you're asking for a restoration of some of those people. Could you give a very high-level overview so the committee can see that in its context?
Certainly, Senator Johnson. Going back through the most recent economic downturn, so back to the 99-01 biennium, we, after factoring out losing positions due to a function being transferred to another agency or those sorts of things, we eliminated, I believe, 159 positions over that period of time, over those two downturns. And you have collectively policy option packages that are not related to specific bills to restore about 14 of those positions. The large majority of those reductions came in the second recession, so in the 2007 to 2011 period, in several waves over various pieces of legislative action. And like I mentioned yesterday, at the time, it was a departure from past practice where, as an agency that's funded by the revenue generated by the work we do, when there's no work, there's no revenue, and thus we keep positions vacant. And rather than hold them vacant and then refill them as the work came back, we were invited by you all at the time to come back and ask for restoration of those positions. And so that range is losing 159 and asking for 14 of them back today.
Thank you. That's exactly what I wanted, so the committee could see this in context and the fact that I think you made very prudent and timely management decisions in the face of an economic crisis, and that the restoration that you're asking for is pretty modest at this point in time. Thank you for that background. Please continue, Madam Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I think what I'll do is I'll skip down to the third bullet just because it does relate to the discussion we were just having about staffing. So one of the key areas of focus that we're going to continue to have in the future is implementing the Affordable Care Act. And a couple of key features that are leading to the discussion about staffing. Oregon has one of the most competitive health insurance markets in the country, and that's great for consumers. It does mean that we do have a lot of work to do to make sure that when all of the insurance companies, and there are more than a dozen, come to bring their products to the market for the individual and small group customers, we have to do all of our review and approval prior to those being available for sale. And you add to that the increased consumer protections and the complexity of implementation of the ACA, it has led to a workload increase for our product regulation team that reviews all of those forms. And so we are also asking for two positions to assist in that workload as well.
Just to put a bit of an exclamation point on that, there are an awful lot of states out there where their individual health insurance market consists of two or three companies, and we have more than a dozen companies here, and the amount of work that goes with that sixfold increase over many other states is the work that Laura's talking about.
May I stop you again? In the implementation of the Federal Affordable Care Act and the catastrophe that we had with Cover Oregon, there are still a number of independent brokers who have been signing people up, both in the private market and in the state market, that are not compensated. And I am hearing from them, as I'm sure others on this panel are, I don't know how that will fall within the purview of your portfolio to try to get this reconciled. What agents were due compensation for placing clients, who weren't, and how we're going to get this scrubbed and up to a point where we're starting sort of fresh with whatever new program we get from Kentucky.
I can speak to that issue to a degree. I think by the calendar, I'm beginning my fourth full week as the head of Cover Oregon, and in those first 3 weeks, this is an issue that has absolutely sailed to the top of the agenda. I've had literally dozens of calls from agents who have been incredibly and justifiably frustrated by this process of being paid commissions that they have often been owed for an extensive period of time. There are reasons that these commissions are hanging out there unpaid, and largely they have to do with reconciling records between Cover Oregon and the carriers who owe the commissions to the agents via Cover Oregon. And it wraps up into data problems with the system that's used to track all that and all those kinds of things. Those really are all in the category of not really the agent's problem. And I think the policy choice that has been made to this point has been to say, we need to minimize the risk of inadvertently overpaying agents' commission and having to recoup that money, and so we need to reconcile this stuff before we can pay them. I am right now exploring whether we've got the legal authority to turn that on its head and basically pay the commissions that we believe to be due to agents, do the reconciliation, and basically have Cover Oregon and thus DCBS absorb the risk of the overpayment issue. Because right now we've been using their money to manage that risk, and that just seems inappropriate if we can get around that at all.
Well, I wish you Godspeed in getting that reconciled, because we're hearing from some pretty cranky people, and not just those agents that were placing people into the private market, but I think there was a generalized misunderstanding about getting people signed up in total, whether it was through the private market or any other state options. And I would agree with you. I'd give plenty of notice to those agents that there might be a clawback if there's a gross overpayment, but to get that money out the door, I think we'd get a lot of very unhappy agents re-energized in the process.
That's what I'm trying very hard to do.
Good. Thank you. Okay. Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'll just touch briefly on the last two points on the slide about what we're going to be looking at in the next biennium. We do have two key pieces of legislation that are aimed at enhancing consumer protection. One is a bill that would establish standards for adequate provider networks for consumers who buy health insurance, and the other would allow us to better regulate the surrender charges that insurance companies charge people who have annuities. And so to do all of this work...
Do you mind... Madam Insurance Commissioner, giving us the number of those two bills.
Madam Chair, my pleasure. So the first bill, the Network Adequacy Bill, is House Bill 2468. And actually, I believe it passed the House this afternoon. And the other bill is House Bill 2467. And I believe that is already passed the House.
Thank you.
Thank you. So to do all of the work that I've described, and you know, as Director Allen mentioned, we are funded differently from the worker safety divisions of DCBS, and we're funded really through assessments and fees levied on those that we regulate. And so you can see the majority of our funding does come from annual assessments and licensing fees that are assessed against the agents and insurance companies and other professionals that we regulate.
And remind the committee, if you will, how those fees are increased or track with increased costs over time.
Madam Chair, so there are a couple of different ways that we charge those fees. And so for the company assessments, it's a percentage of premium that's written in the state. And so as premiums change year over year, which can happen for a number of reasons. So I know Director Allen mentioned economic factors, and there can be different reasons, different demand for different kinds of insurance. And so our assessments are percentage based on those premiums. And the other key piece is that every year we look at the percentage of our division resources that focus on different lines of insurance, so property casualty versus life versus health, and we use that allocation to determine the assessments for the companies who write those different lines of business, so that really it's reflective of the amount of work that we put into regulating those lines of business.
Thank you.
Thank you. So just to kind of put this in context, and I think I've already touched on this a little bit, our revenue can fluctuate a little bit from year over year, and this really has to do more with fluctuation in premium volume more than anything else. And so you just get a kind of a historical perspective, but it has stayed relatively consistent over the last 5 years.
And keeping in mind that, or being mindful of the fact that although we directly charge those we regulate, they pass those costs on. It flew by quickly, I think, on an earlier slide, but it amounts to a half a penny per dollar of insurance premium that pays for the regulatory work that we do.
Thank you.
And the final piece that I wanted to talk about, we do have one key performance measure that's focused on the insurance division, and this is the percent of confirmed complaints that are resolved with relief for consumers. And this is a measure of the effectiveness of the consumer advocacy unit that I talked about before. And with that, that concludes my prepared remarks, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Colleagues, any questions for the insurance commissioner? Thank you for your very excellent testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So continuing with consumer protection, we're going to turn now to the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, which is the primary regulator of financial institutions in the state. One point that we haven't made that I should, everything you just heard about insurance in the U.S. financial regulatory scheme is entirely under state control. There is no federal insurance regulator. We do all of the regulation of insurance companies as each state does at the state level. As we turn to Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, or DFCIS, that model changes substantially as we move to depository institutions. We have shared regulatory responsibility with the federal government. It's a little bit different landscape. But we also have programs in that area that are solely our province. And with that, I'll introduce David Tatman, the administrator of the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, to talk about his programs.
Good afternoon.
Thank you. Thank you, Pat. Madam Chair, members of the committee, as mentioned, I'm David Tatman, the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. With the exception of the insurance side that you've already heard, every other financial service program that is regulated in the state of Oregon is regulated through our division, and there is a long list of those entities involved. You can see on the screen that a number of those would obviously come to mind immediately: banks, credit unions, mortgage lenders, securities brokers, investment advisors, a number of financial service providers to consumers, such as check cashers and consumer finance lenders and alike. So we run a wide gamut of businesses that we oversee. But again, similar to insurance, the standards with which we use are very similar. So we're going to look at, and you heard yesterday about how we focus our time, but we look at licensing, we look at examinations, and we look at outreach and education as well as enforcement as the way that we handle that regulatory practice throughout all the areas that we cover. Our mission is to promote a wide range of products, services, and information through financial service providers, ensuring that they're safe and sound, equitable, and fraud-free. And so we do that, as I said, mostly through the process of licensing and examination. Most of our staff time is dedicated to that. I'm sure you're quite familiar with our process in terms of examining banks and credit unions. But we also go out and examine mortgage lenders, consumer finance lenders, pawn brokers, and even those that engage in providing pre-need services. Those are services for people buying funeral services before their time of need. And so all those are involved with the examination process. But before we get there, we start with licensing. And it may be the chartering of a bank or a credit union, or it may be the licensing of an individual mortgage loan originator. But we want to ensure that they are financially upstanding, and they also, in terms of professional individuals, that they have the qualifications, the background, the education, training, and continuing ongoing training to serve the people of Oregon. And so that's where our licensing process takes place.
Mr. Chapman, is that complaint-driven or randomized?
Madam
As
Chair,
you're doing
by
examinations.
That you mean examinations.
Pardon me? Yes.
Okay. The examination process will change depending on the circumstances, but for most of our programs, they are on a regular schedule. So we're charged with examining credit unions and banks, depending on their circumstances, that is, their ratings. It may be as far out as every 2 years, or it may be as often as every year or even 6 months. So that's on a schedule. Similarly, for mortgage lenders, same thing. They're on a schedule. Investment advisors, which we are charged with regulation, there's a division between the feds and the states, as Pat said. For those state ones, they're on a schedule. So all those are scheduled on a routine basis. But we also have the authority to go in and do for-cause examinations. And so when we get a complaint, when we have a concern, when we hear of a problem, then we will go in and do a for-cause. And so we do both kinds, but the vast majority of our examinations are done on a regularly scheduled basis.
Thank you.
The examinations we do at the banks and at the credit unions are similar, although the product lines may be slightly different, but we are looking to ensure that they are operating in a safe and sound manner. When the Oregonians entrust their money through deposits into these institutions, we want to ensure that those monies are well protected and served. So we will look at that. We will ensure that they're prudentially being taken care of, and that the lending that comes about from that money is well underwritten and reserved for. We also examine all types of entities for compliance to ensure that they're complying with state law, federal law, the standards that the Congress and this body has laid out to ensure that people are treated fairly and that they are fully informed before they make a decision. So that's the majority of our licensing. Further down, you can see securities is something that is a little bit different. So our securities industry, I might want to go back one. The securities industry is slightly different in that we're looking at products that people want to invest in. So we review the products that people are making investment decisions on, stocks, debentures, and other types of products like that. We also are, again, looking at the individuals who are charged with selling those. There's been a lot of interest lately, and I understand there's a question raised yesterday about crowdfunding. And crowdfunding is a very loose term, but crowdfunding in this regard is allowing the public to get involved at an early level to promote and provide funding for Oregon businesses. So we met with a member of this actual committee, and we've met with business advocates, small business advocates, and in light of the recent Dodd-Frank Act, which charged the SEC with coming forward with something that would allow for small startup business within each state, so that's an intrastate loan, we came up with the process of establishing an exemption that will allow for people, the public, to be able to invest in startup companies. Now, it's a balancing act. We wanted to make sure that investor protection continued, because that's the foremost thing that we're charged with, but we also wanted to ensure that companies were able to raise capital, especially these new startup companies. So through the process of rulemaking, we were able to establish what I believe is a very good rule that allows for crowdfunding in Oregon. We're one of about 15 states that allows for that. It started in January. We've already had 12 companies file either an expression of interest or start the process, or in fact have raised funds through this new crowdfunding. So that's a new thing that we're doing through the securities field.
Mr. Tapman, help me understand this. I generally get the notion of crowdfunding, but there are other mechanisms by which people are either solicited or induced into making contributions over the internet. And to what degree are you taking a look at those that may fall outside the strict definition of crowdfunding as a product? Is it sort of buyer beware if one is making these, especially in the charitable realm?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, absolutely correct. So this is our focus is securities, raising capital for businesses, and in this case, small business in Oregon. The Attorney General's Office is responsible for charitable matters. I know the Federal Trade Commission is very actively looking at the part of crowdfunding you're describing, where people are being solicited just to donate money under the auspices of maybe getting some kind of small item back, or be the first one to get one of the books, or the first one to get that kind of credit. It is not within our purview. It would be within the general purview of either the Department of Justice or the federal oversight.
So just as a curiosity, if I participate in crowdfunding, do I become an equity, do I hold an equity position in the company? How did you define that?
Madam Chair, we said that you had to be one, an entity registered in the state of Oregon. So you registered with the Secretary of State. You have to be smaller than 50 employees. You can raise up to $250,000, and you can do it either through equity, so buying stock, and then there's certain disclosures that come down, or person can do it through debentures or notes. They can do that so that they can get repaid from the operating capital generated by that. But the key I want to focus is on that this is not a Wild West process. We have a number of disclosures that we've gone through that the rule requires. It's an exemption, so we don't actually review for a fair, just, and equitable standards like we do with stock reviews, because we were trying to reduce the cost and allow for these small businesses to get started up in this area. But we still balance those two competing interests. And we think we've hit the mark just about right. However, and it's just in the first quarter, so we're certainly open to listening and watching to see if we need to fine-tune it a little bit.
Thank you. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say thank you to David and DCBS. I've been involved in some of that discussion as a result of my interest in the sort of entrepreneurial ecosystem, and in an era when we're probably all too familiar with experiences where state agencies and others come up with reasons why something can't happen. This stands in really nice stark contrast to that. I think the department and Mr. Tapman and his team particularly have struck a really good balance. This is, of course, available through an exemption of the federal legislation, and not every state is taking advantage of it. It gives us, I think, a chance to make it easier for businesses to grow and expand. Not every business is going to turn into something huge, but it does give a chance for entrepreneurs and for Oregonians who want to be more than just customers for some of these businesses to take part in it. So kudos to you, and particularly for your openness to trying to get this balance right and to being open to adjustment as we gain experience with it.
Thank you, Chair. Please continue, Mr. Taylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So next screen, these are areas that are reflected in the past year and the upcoming 2 years. And you'll see this more graphically shown in the next graph. But the fact is that we are watching the number of banks and credit unions change through mergers and just to some degree new charters, but mostly through mergers, which will show that we're having fewer banks but of larger size. Likewise, we are spending a considerable amount of time looking at the internet. The internet obviously is a new area for a lot of areas, for a lot of practices, and so we are particularly focused in that area to make sure the consumers using the internet do two things. One, they understand what they're getting into, and two, that they recognize that there are people that are licensed and are willing to work within the parameters set forth in Oregon law, and those that aren't licensed and are outside of that. And to do that, as you can see in the last bullet point, we have several people that are engaged in outreach, and we provide outreach on any number of topics, including identity theft protection, and we work on mortgage lending and foreclosure practices and protections, and then just basic investor protections. And we're now just starting on something regarding retirement services. We see that as a pressing need, and I know this body has heard a lot about retirement services in the recent weeks, and we think there is a need for consumer awareness. Okay. So you can see going forward, as I've mentioned, there's a number of things that we're working on, focusing on seniors, and in particular is that they are the most vulnerable and those approaching the retirement area. The one thing I haven't touched much on, and that is our enforcement efforts. We have several attorneys involved in this area who provide a number of services, both investigative as well as administrative, civil, and criminal. We take particular pride in the fact that we are able to step in and provide resources for any number of agencies, both federal and state, district attorneys, U.S. attorneys, and help them in any number of ways to ensure that the worst wrongdoers are criminally prosecuted. And with that, we'll turn to the two, our three bills. You can see that.
Mr. Tapman, excuse me. Co-Chair Gomberg.
Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. We can just back up one slide.
Sure.
I wanted to ask about our efforts to deal with financial fraud, particularly in the senior community. And help me a little bit with the potential, again, as I suggested yesterday, for the potential for redundancy in some of the work being done by the Attorney General's office in trying to communicate these potential issues to people.
Madam Chair and Representative Gomberg, I think this is a situation where there isn't enough redundancy yet. We need to organize in a better way. So one of the charges that I've given my outreach people is to find ways to work with the Attorney General's office to make sure that when they go out, they've got our message, and when we go out, we're at least aware of what their key concerns are, because there are so many groups, and frankly, most of our outreach is done to small groups, and so we'll be at a retirement center or even a senior home or something of that nature. We may have 5, we may have 15, if we're lucky, we have 25 or 30, and so there's really, it's just a little bite of the apple many times. And so there isn't a lot of redundancy. I'd like to think that there's plenty of room for partnership, and we probably could do it even better than we do in terms of working together.
Here in the Ways and Means Committee, it's worth observing that how these functions in the two agencies are funded actually has a fairly meaningful impact on what they do and how they do that. You don't give either us or the Department of Justice general purpose tax dollars and say, go protect the financial interests of the elderly. You give the Department of Justice authority to pursue wrongdoers and be able to use settlement money from those cases or you know the results of those cases to deal with those issues. And you give us these slices that I talked about of regulatory authority and the licensing revenue that comes from those. And those both push us in somewhat different directions based on the way the color of the money or the limitations the funding has. Probably neither of those outcomes, either separately or when you roll it all up, is what you would set out to go create if you were to just go create generalized consumer protection as a single function.
Thank you. Yeah. So members of the committee, the next two things are slides, and they're reflective really on how the two slides seen together reflect on how we are also dependent on the economy, just like many of the businesses that we regulate. And so you can see that during the economic downturn, the number of institutions, particularly banks and credit unions, went down. Although, because there are so relatively few of them, the movement shouldn't be reflected as a major downturn. Similarly, you can see in the red, which is a greater number using the left-hand axis, is the mortgage bankers, brokers, and they went through a substantial downturn period, but they have bounced back up to some degree through the refinance and that we've seen in the last few years with a downturn in interest rates. But all of those reflect what is shown here, and that is our revenue pattern. That too shows that we are somewhat cyclically dependent in terms of the number of institutions that are getting licensed with us and the number of institutions in terms of the assets they hold. But it also conveys to some degree that we are counter-cyclical, and I think it's an important thing to remember that because when banks and credit unions are going through difficult times economically, we have to meet with them more frequently. We're in there maybe every 6 months, but we're also working much more closely with them in terms of the challenges that they're facing. And so because of that, we actually had to gear up and ramp up during some of the highest parts of the economic downturn. And just now, as we watch banks and credit unions in a situation to improve and are showing better financial circumstances, we are now down, ramping downward a little bit in terms of our staffing and in terms of our need to oversee on a regular basis.
Thank you, Mr. Tapman. We have a question, Representative Whitsitt.
I was wondering, do you oversee the Treasurer's Office investments and who they invest their state funds with? And if you don't, who does?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we do not. DFCUS does not have that responsibility, and so I'm unable to answer that. I would have to defer back to someone else.
Mr. Allen?
I think you do.
Yeah, the Oregon Investment Council does.
So the last slide is one of our key performance measures, and it tells a good story in that you can see that during the height, as we started the economic downturn in 2008, you can watch the downward trend of the institutions that were rated satisfactory or better. That's just our tool for going in and determining the health and safety and soundness of the institutions that we regulate. And then as we come out of the nadir of 2010, we start to come back up. And by the time we get to 2014, you can see that we've actually exceeded what we expected the target to be, and we think that trend is continuing now. So we're encouraged. This is a reflection of the hard work that our banks, credit unions, and other institutions have done. It's a reflection of the work we've done, and it's obviously a reflection of the economy.
And this is actually a good performance measure to just sort of highlight the art of the selection of key performance measures and the mix of what are large-scale things that are meaningful indicators of performance of industries that we regulate or other factors, and what are direct reflections of our work. If you were to look at this in 2010, in one way you would be tempted to say, well, we must be doing a really bad job because the quality of the financial institutions is dropping. You know, that's really not what this is reflective of, and it's that notion that we track things that we have a role to play in dealing with, but often the results are things that are not directly under our control, and so they're reflective of the general economy. We try to, in each of our KPMs, we try to balance that perspective to try to get them to be meaningful numbers.
Thank you. Colleagues, does that conclude your presentation?
It does.
Madam Chair,
I love
yes.
The fact you used the word nadir. colleagues, any questions of Mr. Tapman? Thank you very
Thank you.
Much.
All right, moving on.
Mr. Allen,
yes.
Before we move on, I've been sitting here thinking about the fact that Cover Oregon now lives with you.
I think about it every day, Madam
I bet
Chair.
You do. And I'm going to actually make you think about it more. I think for many of us, when Senate Bill 1 passed, and as it has been described, we euthanized Cover Oregon, and we now have a new home for it with you, that some people are beginning to think this is unfinished business. And what I'm trying, I mean, that it's finished business. Mm-hmm. What I'm trying to get at is, where is the point where the legislature broadly, not just leadership, but the legislature, is informed about what's coming for our participation in Cover Oregon? The federal money is declining. At some point in time, we've insured more people, at some of them very high need folks. When is the collision that I think some of us think is pending going to occur, and in what venue will you and others involved with the health authority and or Cover Oregon begin to disclose to the legislature the magnitude of the pending problem?
Senator Johnson, I guess I'm not sure I'm completely willing to accept your setup for the question, but what I will say is Partly, you're going to hear some significant discussion tomorrow of CoverOregon as part of our presentation, and at least the operational issues related to it, and some discussion of policy issues. My expectation certainly is that my reporting to you collectively as a body over the interim and on into the future is extensive, and that's irrespective of what the bill calls for, which I think is pretty close. I've joked to the notion that I have to come by each of your houses in the interim and have a conversation with you about where we are. But I think there are sets of issues around the smooth operational integration of CoverOregon into DCBS. There are issues around the underlying policy framework of healthcare reform and where that sits, which I think is what you're getting at. There are regulatory issues that really are properly insurance division issues around the functioning of insurance companies within this marketplace as various elements of the ACA come and go. I think that provides a variety of topics that our expectation is to come have conversations with you and largely in relevant policy committees on a very regular basis as we try to deal with those. And that's to say nothing of any kind of discussion of technology. Honestly, in the bill, if we have any sort of a technology ask as a part of moving forward with marketplace operations, we are required to notify each and every one of you individually of those asks. And so there's a yet another forum for that. Does that get at what you're concerned about?
It actually does, quite adequately. I think in a conversation that I was having with some colleagues earlier today, the question was, who tells the legislature about what's happening? And I may have overly predicated my comment by implying it was something drastically bad. But mostly the question was, who is the messenger that describes to the legislature what the ongoing issues are before we have that oh my God moment when we realize we're out another fill in the blank number of millions of dollars? And you have addressed that question by enumerating the elements that I think are appropriate elements for you to be worried about. And I think you have also clearly identified yourself as the messenger to the legislature to begin this dialogue about what should be expected. I think another thing that colors my question is in listening to certain co-chairs who will remain nameless for the purpose of this question, talking about future biennium where things may be much more fiscally constrained due to accelerated costs in CoverOregon. But you've identified yourself as one of the messengers, and I think that's what I hope to accomplish.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks. In that case, we're ready to move on to the last portion of consumer protection, and I think we'll be able to bring this in just under the wire. I asked Mark Long to join me at the table to talk about the Building Codes Division, which has a mission around construction safety, but also really an economic development mission around the construction environment in the state. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mark to talk about his division.
Welcome, Mr. Long.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mark Long, Administrator, Building Codes. Bear with me. I had a coughing attack earlier today.
Do you need some water?
I think I'm okay for now, but I'll get up and you'll know if I need it. What we do at Building Codes is we adopt uniform building codes that are used in 130 communities around the state. These codes are structural codes, plumbing codes, electrical codes, boiler, elevator, even fire codes. The purpose of that, as Director Allen indicated, is to provide a predictable and consistent business environment for those contractors that work in multiple communities around Oregon. We also resolve disputes between businesses and local government when questions of code or interpretation or application occur. Thank you very much.
Just in case.
Just in case. We license some of the trades workers, primarily electricians, plumbers, and folks that work in the boiler industry, and then we license the local inspectors that work in 130 different communities around Oregon. And we also serve as a relief valve for local government and businesses, providing services where local government chooses not to, or on special projects where expertise or capacity isn't available locally for us to perform that work.
Mr. Long, you have put a particular emphasis on 130 communities. There are 200 plus incorporated cities.
Correct.
Would you explain that 130?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, there are 242 cities thereabouts that are authorized in 36 counties. But on the building code side, the state has jurisdiction for the entire state. Local communities can choose, if they choose to, meet certain standards, carry out those programs independently. We've only had 130 requested as of today. And that number doesn't vary dramatically. We had a few drop off during the economic downturn because of revenue issues, and the state picked those up.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Our goals are to support economic development through technology, use of apps for business, for contractors to conduct business with us, e-permitting I'll talk about in a little bit, and then video training for inspectors, and down the road you'll be seeing video inspections. We focus on rural Oregon. We think it's very important to make sure that we don't have a one-size-fits-all approach to code compliance. There are different safety issues when you're dealing in high-dense urban areas that you are in other areas of the state. So we adopt codes to meet those rural areas. Just to give you some examples, one that we're kind of proud of here that we did lately, juniper is a big issue, and the legislature, I think, had some discussion about that here several weeks ago. And we've adopted some standards recognizing the use of juniper wood for decks, porches, and anywhere where it would come in contact with earth. So those kind of things come out of our kind of rural attention, if you will, both supporting those local economies as well as then looking at the building code, how it can help foster that growth in those areas.
Mr. Long?
Yeah.
What you just said causes me to ask the following question. As we are pioneering in Oregon new techniques of using lumber, not just a traditional types like juniper, but also these highly laminated, very strong products that are coming out of research at OSU.
Correct.
That you can now build a multi-story building out of wood, which would have been unthinkable a very short time ago. What are you going to do to try to update and harmonize some of our codes with respect to this new product, fire, for example? Is that ongoing in your sort of task list?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we already have. As recently as January, I believe, and I'll have to, of course, be corrected by my staff who would know more, but we updated our codes to recognize a taller application of cross-laminated timber, CLT, the technical term. We're probably one of the first organizations to do that. We've also put out several position papers and communicated with the industry on how they can use, I don't want to get too nerdy here, but the performance code that we made available in Oregon so that it can be engineered out and use taller buildings. And then we're monitoring it. We have a couple projects going on in the Portland area, and we anticipate that we'll be providing some of the services there to make sure in this kind of new technology state, in that relief valve capacity that we have, that the project can go forward timely and efficiently. So we're pretty lucky here in Oregon. We have many tools in our bag in our tool chest here that we don't have in other states to respond rapidly to, whether it's juniper, CLT, EV equipment, electric vehicle equipment, or any of the other kinds of new technologies. We've passed legislation in 05 anticipating these issues, and I have pretty broad authority to react quickly. The issues around CLT, just so you know, are going to be getting folks comfortable with the idea, and that's going to take some time. You don't have that issue with the state, but you have many fire districts and many local communities that are going to need training and education to get kind of comfortable, as well as the architect and engineering community in Oregon.
And the building trades, I think.
Exactly.
Thank you.
But we're there, and we'll be having projects coming forward.
Cool. Thank you.
I think on e-permitting, just so everybody knows, e-permitting is a system we've been working on for many years where the state provides software and services to local communities to help them provide services to their businesses, their contractors, so that folks can apply, pay, and receive their building permits online 24/7. We've got about 38 communities that use what we call our first service program, and we've got another 20 using our partial program. It's a great system, and it's one of the main ways that we help local communities and then rural area contractors get those timely, efficient services from state or local government. Turning the page. Are you on it? Awesome. We also are in the process of retraining our building inspectors. I'm going to talk a little bit about demographics here in just a little bit, but we're going to have a significant amount of our inspectors retire out of the system. Local communities are having difficulty finding qualified folks. We're cross-training inspectors. We're doing custom training programs. We're working in areas like Harney County, Klamath County, Newport to provide custom approaches for areas where they brought in new building officials, recognizing out-of-state credentials, which we haven't historically. Lots of activity going on around the training of inspectors. Not everybody agrees with it, but we're leading the way because we think we need to prepare for the change that's going to occur in the next 5 years. We provide many options for businesses. What's really important to our organization is we do provide these kind of prescriptive building codes that say, here's how you put your 2x4s together, but we want to create performance standards. If you can engineer it, we'll allow it. We adopt the latest national codes, whether they're required or not. We make them available, so if there's a better path that's come out from somewhere around the country, contractors can use that if they choose to. And then one of our newer products is a concept called ready-built plans, where we provide prototypical drawings on our website that in any local community or at the state, customers can come in if they got a pole barn, it's ready to go. They pick from a menu, plan review's done. If they got their land use dealt with, they can walk out with their permit. We do it for decks, garages, and now we're going to begin working on what I would call simple house designs for contractors that want to pick from those menu of choices that we're providing. We think those are great options and help speed up the regulatory process. And then just a constant theme for our organization is regulatory streamlining, and just overall I would put the e-permitting in that category. We're working on electronic plan submittal, kind of break down the geographic barriers so folks don't have to drive and you can move things around. And then alternate permits, such as the minor labels, which I'll talk about in the performance, which allows contractors to buy permits ahead of time in bulk, and then they're transferable from community to community so that they don't have to be put in a position of replacing a water heater at 2 o'clock in the morning where they have a building permit or not. They're ready to go. They've bought them ahead of time, and we make those available to our customers through our regulatory streamlining efforts. Just a couple issues so that you kind of know what's impacting construction globally in Oregon. I mentioned demographics. We're going to have about 85% of our local inspectors are over the age of 45. We believe about 30% of those are going to leave the system within the next 5 years. That's why we're redoubling our training efforts, and we're preparing for what I see coming, both on the contractor side, frankly, but on the inspector side, which I work more closely with, kind of a whole new generation of folks coming into the system. We have construction growth occurring in many areas, but in other areas it's not, so that creates challenges for communities that maybe not have the large institutional projects to kind of keep their programs going, and we're trying to manage that across the state. And then making sure that with our various sister agencies, we reduce the duplication of effort so that if you deal with my shop or CCB or fire, one of the other agencies, that we're a little bit better coordinated than what we've historically been. Economic growth. What's that? Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, I apologize. Sorry. Representative Whitsett.
Could you repeat the sentence that you said about replacing the water heater in the middle of the night?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Wood said it was probably just an example, but let's say it's a water heater and it requires a permit. Okay.
Okay, that I just want to stop there. Do you need a permit in the state to replace a broken water heater?
I believe so. I'd have to check with the folks that know more about that, but I believe so. And you can purchase those permits online. I assume that it's required for GAP, for ones that are under the gas systems, would be my guess.
Do you need
help getting a permit?
No. Okay. I was just wondering, is it only for gas water heaters?
So, Juan, could you refine your answer and get it back to the professional staff, and that way we won't be guessing?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Cool.
I don't keep track of all the permits and all the licenses and all the different things. There's a host of staff that does that. Talk about economic growth. Just so you know, building codes permits, the ones that we issue, are up about 13% since 2011. That's kind of the down point that we saw in the construction side, is somewhere around the 2011 and things started bumping back up. That represents about 55,000 permits right now. Just to give you a sense, there's 225,000 additional permits issued in local government. We've got local communities are up about 12% since 2011, and employment in construction is up between 10 and 13% since 2011. So we're seeing coming out of the downturn that occurred in our sector around 08, 09. You'll see on the next slide our revenue. Our revenue is strong.
Mr. Long, I'm going to interrupt you one more time.
Yeah.
Representative Whitsitt.
Could you provide this committee with a list of what you need a permit for? I'm sure you have it somewhere.
No, Madam Chair, not. I mean, I will do that. We do not have something that's a full list, but I will get staff working on it. It probably won't be a 24-hour turnaround, Representative Whitsitt.
No, that's fine. Okay. I would just like to know what we have to pay permits for and the amount of the permit under your building code division. And I'm talking about replacement things, whatever, in a normal home. I'll just...
It varies through local community, so I'm happy to give you what we do. If you're interested in the community that you come from, I can work with Klamath Falls as well.
State.
It varies, but I'll get you what we have, okay?
It's a real, if I could, Madam Chair, Representative Whitsitt, it's an incredibly complicated, if we expand it to the fees, local governments set the fees, we have state fees where we have jurisdiction, there's a mix of jurisdictions back to that 130 cities and counties that operate a program. The answer would be really complicated.
I'm looking for what you oversee and what you would enforce in the state.
Well, so there's two things that we do. We directly issue permits in places like Umatilla County, where we are the local building department. We oversee the local issuance of permits in the 130 jurisdictions that are the actual retail transaction for the permit. And so if by oversee, it's all of it. If it's directly issue, it's a subset.
I guess I'd like to see it all. Thanks.
Perhaps in order to refine this a little bit, you could get with Representative Whitsitt and make sure that you're responsive. I think what got you was the water heater in the middle of the night permit.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Just so the committee has some context, not to make it worse for myself, I mean, it's electrical, plumbing, structural, mechanical, elevator, boiler, energy. It's pretty extensive depending upon the work you do and the complexity, and it's administered by 130 different communities. So we'll get you what we can.
Thank you.
Okay?
Okay. Please continue.
That ends it.
Oh, lovely.
Questions?
Colleagues, any other questions for Mr. Long? I have one in the closing minutes of the ball game, and
sure.
That is how closely you're coordinating with CCB, Construction Contractors Board, at this point. Under the old administration, my phone just rang off the hook with complaints. I think things are settling with Mr. Deno now at the Construction Contractors Board. I have heard about discussions between you and Mr. Deno about where you could collaborate or be helpful to each other. Could you give us a little status report on that?
Sure. Well, Madam Chair, the first answer to your question is we're collaborating now more than ever for the exact reasons that you illustrated. Specifically, we also worked with the Construction Contractors Board and our contractor industry on House Bill, I believe it's 2843, but I could be wrong, that has moved out of the House and is sitting in the Senate waiting for review after probably the first chamber deadline. And that bill allows us to work more closely in about three main areas: technology, and you have to have legislation to do this, believe it or not, license applications, and enforcement. So we're informally doing it now through improved communications. Jim and I meet constantly, our staff meet constantly, but we're also working on making sure that if I have to buy a licensing system and I license contractors and he needs one, that we're going to use the same thing so the customer has a consistent experience. We want to set up the ability so that I can take an application for his department in my office. About 20% of our walk-in customers are actually for his business, not for mine, and it makes no sense to send them shuttling across the city, that I could take that in. There's some complex accounting things that we need the legislation for to kind of fix and true up. Then he could do the same, make it real easy for each other. And then we're beginning the process of aligning our enforcement areas so that he's not sending folks out to a construction site and then we're sending out folks to a construction site, that we can partner up on those. And those are just the ones that we've started to talk about. So it's much more than ever. So that's on working closely. And then there are always ongoing conversations about the two agencies' discussion as a whole. So
thank you. Colleagues, any other questions of Mr. Long?
Madam Chair, if not, that concludes our consumer protection presentation for today. Tomorrow we'll come back and spend some time talking in more detail about Cover Oregon and its implications for the operations of the organization and the budget, and then reserve the balance of the time for public testimony.
Okay. That sounds great. Any comments from LFO?
No.
Okay. Colleagues, anything else for the good of the order? There being nothing, we're adjourned.